历史上世界各国不乏实验室泄露甚至导致严重后果的例子，要证明实验室泄露为什么如此困难，历史事件对新冠调查有什么启示？另外，新冠疫情进入第二年，正在引发另一波健康危机。大家好，欢迎收看美国之音的时事大家谈，我是叶凡。将近一年半过去了，新冠疫情起源仍然是一个谜。不过，一度被称为阴谋论的实验室泄露假设正在得到越来越多的关注。历史上世界各国不乏实验室泄露甚至导致严重后果的例子，其中一些事故的根源至今没有明确的答案。那要证明实验室泄露为什么如此的困难，要如何堵住生物安全方面的漏洞，历史事件对新冠调查有什么启示？今天我们邀请乔治亚大学历史学家史蒂文·米姆博士来分析和讨论。米姆博士是2010年《纽约时报》十大畅销书的作家之一，也是美国史密森学会莱梅尔森发明与创新研究中心的杰出研究员。Professor Mim, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
In your article entitled "The History of Lab Leaks Has Lots of Entries,recently published on Bloomberg, you said, the history of lab safety shows that leaks of pathogens have happened in the past, sometimes with deadly consequences. It also shows that even transparent, thorough investigations into the origins of an outbreak can end in uncertainty. Why is it so difficult to prove lab leaks? Could you give us such an example?
Absolutely. So the primary reason lab leaks are so difficult to understand and get to the bottom of has a lot to do with the fact that oftentimes the labs themselves don't know what happened. So a good case in point is the famous last known death of smallpox, which is one of the worst virulent, most virulent pathogens in human history.In 1979, there was a lab leak in a British lab of people studying smallpox. At this point, smallpox was no longer in the wild, and a medical photographer in the lab died after being exposed to the pathogen. She herself did not have access to the area where they were studying the pathogens, and in an initial inquiry in Great Britain, which was open and transparent, concluded that it was the ventilation system. But a subsequent report correctly concluded that there was no way she could have gotten it through the ventilation system. And so they ultimately had to conclude that somehow she had breached protocol and entered into the space that the smallpox was being studied. That's in a society...Great Britain, where they did a very open, transparent inquiry, and that took several years. And we still don't know what happened in 1979 at that facility. And that gives you some sense of just how easy it is for a pathogen to escape through human error, through mistakes, through a failure to follow protocol, and how then thatas a consequence, makes it almost impossible sometimes to reconstruct precisely what happened.
Yeah, in the same article you wrote, when lab leaks take place in a secretive society, the difficult job of confirming the source of an outbreak gets much harder. Can you please explain why and give us some typical examples of that event?
Absolutely. So in any case where there's a lab leak of a deadly pathogen, it's somewhat human. It's a very human tendency to want to either cover it up or minimize it. And in a secretive society, say the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War, which is a good example, you had a system where there wasn't really any interest whatsoever in divulging truth to either the Soviet people, much less admitting that to your adversary. In this case, it was the United States. So in the Soviet Union, there was a very famous incident, again, in the 1970s, where there were rumors of an outbreak of anthrax at a city called Sverdlovsk, which is a secretive city, fairly remote. And we couldn't in the United States figure out what had happened. And eventually the Soviets admitted there had been an anthrax outbreak, and they blamed it on frozen meat, that frozen meat, contaminated meat, had killed off a bunch of people. And American scientists actually collaborated with the Soviets in showing that this had happened, supposedly. Unfortunately, that was actually not what happened. In fact, the Soviets had covered up what had happened, which was that they were operating a bioweapons facility in a place called Compound 19, which was manufacturing aerosolized, weaponized anthrax. And in that case, someone had forgotten to change a filter in the anthrax facility. It was an error, again, not purposeful at all. It was an error. And it had killed off approximately 70 people. We don't even know for sure how many died of anthrax. This only came to light after the end of the Soviet Union. It only really came to light in the late 1980s and beginning in the early 1990s, when the American scientist who had initially endorsed the so-called frozen meat theory turned out and realized when Soviet pathologists who had secretly kept specimens from the lungs of victims divulged the truth, and the truth finally came out. But that's a great example here. You have, 20 years of obfuscation and cover-up. That's how long it took. And right now, obviously, in the case of COVID-19, we don't know what happened. I think that's a point worth making.
Right.
And it may well be that the Chinese government may not fully know what happened either, which is also a point worth making.
But in the former Soviet Union case, you pointed out it was the intelligence, not the scientists, who finally solved the puzzles. So
absolutely. No, it's fascinating, actually, because, we like to believe that scientists are infallible, but when they're working with incomplete evidence, and especially, God help us, if they're working with falsified evidence, as they were with the anthrax outbreak, It's oftentimes the intelligence services that can provide a more clearer look, because they're used to weighing the kind of ambiguity that comes with these sorts of incidents.
So the U.S. intelligence state investigates through the satellite pictures and talk to
right.
the survivors. Yeah. So
yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. Well, in the case of the anthrax episode, The satellite photos actually showed at the time that there were decontamination trucks headed to the city, which is not incompatible with the frozen meat explanation, but suggested that something truly catastrophic had happened. The entire city was shut down. So that was an indication that there was a problem that went beyond a simple ingestion of ordinary anthrax.
So now President Biden ordered the U.S. intelligence to investigate the origin of COVID-19. How hopeful are you that without China's cooperation, the U.S. intelligence could find the answers to the COVID origin? Are 90 days enough?
No, I think if history tells us anything, we're going to need a lot more than 90 days, I'm afraid. The only thing that could happen, I suppose, is that there could be other forms of evidence that start to materialize that are more conclusive, either through defectors or people who can perhaps reconstruct some of what's happened on both in the lab and also potentially, and we don't know this, if there was any manipulation of the virus itself, which is a separate issue from whether it leaked from the lab. These are all in the popular imagination. Unfortunately, all of this is getting mixed together, but it's quite possible to have a natural origin for the virus, meaning it's an existing virus that leaked from a lab. It's also possible to have an enhanced version of a natural virus that leaked from a lab. And it's also, of course, popular to have a natural origin, period. So these things are all very complicated and complex. But the good news is that I suspect the truth will ultimately come out, as it usually does in these matters.
Some newly uncovered video of the Wuhan Institute of Virology claims that bats were kept in the lab. More concerns have been raised that Peter Daszak, a member of WHO investigation team of the COVID origin, has conflict of interest. Well, Peter Daszak denies there were bats kept in the lab and there was no study of gain of function in the Wuhan lab. Peter Daszak is the president of EcoHealth Alliance, who founded the Wuhan Institute of Virology's research on bat SARS-related coronaviruses. So do you have any confidence for the future investigation, again, by WHO team?
I think the WHO has no credibility whatsoever in this, to put it bluntly. They produced a report that was generated by a team that was handpicked by the Chinese government and was prominently led by a man with the most and biggest conflicts of interest of all, arguably, in all of this, Dr. Daszak. So the idea that the WHO will get to the bottom of this, I think, is laughable. We'll see. What you raise, though, is an immensely important point as well, in that there have been repeated conflicts of interest that have surfaced, most famously in the original Lancet letter, the letter in the British Scientific Journal that Daszak had put together, had brokered, dismissing the lab leak hypothesis. And it is a hypothesis, it's not a proven fact, but he dismissed it as a quote-unquote conspiracy theory. And, you know, now we know a lot more, and what we know suggests that he, and by extension, to some extent, the WHO, are not credible on this issue at all.
Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb said, these kinds of lab leaks happen all the time, even in here in the United States. We had mishaps, and in China, the last known outbreaks of SARS-1 have been out of labs. So one well-known example in the U.S. is that in the 2001, anthrax stolen from a federal bioweapons lab killed 5 people and sickened 17 more. So what measures has the U.S. taken or should take to prevent biosafety leaks?
At this point, biosafety is, in my own mind, as a historian, a rather terrifying question that demands further oversight and regulation, because as you point out, there have been leaks in the United States, which has done an otherwise commendable job of trying to enforce lab safety. But working with high-level pathogens, virulent pathogens, even at a biosafety level 4 facility is no guarantee, as we know, that there will not be leaks. What's particularly worrisome, in my own mind, is that the number of BSL biosafety level 4 facilities is growing around the world and operating in countries that historically have had a mixed record of compliance with international protocols. Given that, if it can happen here in the United States, it could certainly happen in other countries. And that should give us all considerable unease, not even about COVID, but simply about going forward in the future, that this is an area that demands much more oversight and regulation than it's currently getting.
Mm-hmm. So what lessons can we learn from these events in the history?
Well, the first is that we need to be patient and let the intelligence services and the scientists do their work without the kind of second guessing that I'm afraid we're seeing a lot of lately. The second is that we're going to need to give them time, that we need to be patient, and I'm afraid 90 days is probably insufficient. The third is that there needs to be probably much more international coordination and oversight of safety in labs. And then the fourth, which is a hypothetical, but I think is a question that needs to be addressed, is that some of the debate over the lab leak, quote unquote, in Wuhan concerns the possibility that the WIV was doing so-called gain of function research. this is a very controversial line of scientific research. There was a moratorium on it in the United States. It should also, in all likelihood, be the subject of some international discussion about what sort of research should be conducted and under what kind of guidelines and safety.
Thank you so much, Professor Min. Pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks.
好，非常感谢乔治亚大学历史学家史蒂文·米姆博士的分析和讨论。来宾发表的都是个人意见，并不一定代表美国之音。接下来，新冠疫情进入第二年，正在引发另一波健康危机，请不要走开，我们马上回来。欢迎回到时事大家谈，我是叶凡。新冠病毒让全球1.7亿多感染，370多万人死亡。疫情进入第二年，持续的压力正在引发另一波健康危机。美国心理学会的最新调查显示，一年多来，大约一半的美国成年人体重改变、失眠、推迟或者取消看病计划等等。卫生专家警告说，疫情压力对人们的心理和身体健康造成了严重的影响，即使在新冠疫情得到控制之后，可能仍然会持续很久。那怎么样来识别压力对健康发出的危险信号？怎么样打破压力和健康的恶性循环？我们又可以寻求哪些医疗干预手段？今天我们邀请维吉尼亚州的家庭医生金冲飞来分析和解答。金医生，非常感谢您参加今天的访谈。
大家好，主持人好。
那金医生，我们现在疫情已经进入了第二年，那长期的压力对身心健康有哪些影响，又体现在哪些方面呢？
的确是这样子，在过去的一年我在门诊接诊的病人里面就是有这种焦虑情绪的，有压力的这部分人特别的多，比以往就是在疫情之前多了很多。只要你安下心来跟他们稍微多聊几句，你发现他们都会有很多的各种来自各种方面的这种压力在那里。比如说疫情期间小朋友在家里上学了，然后呢他们到底是去上班呢，还是在家里监督小朋友上课呢？还有一些人失业了，就经济上也会有很大的压力。那这些压力呢都迫使他们有些时候如果就医呢，它就会造成可能比较昂贵的这个医疗费用。如果不就医呢，长期以来呢，这个压力的不断积聚可能会导致更严重的问题。这也是为什么最近从我们医生的角度来说的话，这个精神科的医生啊就特别的忙。那美国的还有一种职业呢叫做 therapist， 他会给你做一种心理的疏导，会做一种行为学上的一些指导。他们如果觉得你需要用药了，那他们可能进一步再推荐你看精神科的医生。那这个压力除了这些方面以外呢，其实身体上的压力也蛮大的。这个真的是一种压力，因为它本身就是一种重力，就是很多人就是疫情期间就是体重增加的情况，这也给他们带来了很大的压力。
对，这个美国心理学会在今年二月有一份调查显示，60%以上的美国成年人体重发生了不是他们想要的改变。那其中呢，40%以上的人体重平均增长了29磅，也就是13公斤。那18%的人呢，体重减轻了26磅，也就是相当于12公斤。那在一年当中，这样大幅度的这个体重变化，会给健康带来什么样的影响呢？
的确是这样子。我自己对这个体重的问题呢，在一年之前也开始关注了。然后在我自己逻辑医学的微信公众号上，我也做过同样的调查，就是显示呢，有53%的人表明他在过去一年的里面呢是有体重增加的情况，而34%的人体重不变，13%的人体重减轻。这个体重的忽上忽下，其实对身体影响还是蛮大的，尤其是体重的增加。体重的增加呢，它会导致大家熟悉的高血糖、高血压、高血脂，还有一些人不是特别熟悉的，比如说叫 sleep apnea， 就这个毛病的话，
障碍。
对对对，就呼吸障碍。这个毛病呢，就是大家熟悉的可能就打呼啊，但是呢，有些时候你不打呼也可能有这种呼吸障碍的情况。所以说这个都要引起大家的重视，尤其是有些人体重增加了之后，他的脖子增粗的，那这种人群呢，就是更容易导致这个 这个 sleep apnea 这种情况。还有呢，体重增加了之后会导致这个关节的疼痛，尤其是膝关节需要承受更大的压力。还有呢，可以导致这个脂肪肝。脂肪肝的话，大家可能也比较熟悉，因为在我们华人里面，这个乙肝的比例是非常高的。就是乙肝呢，它如果再加上脂肪肝呢，它就更容易形成一种纤维化，最后导致呢肝硬化，然后最后走向肝癌，这些都是大家不希望看到的。
那体重只是很多疾病的一种可能比较明显的一种迹象、一种症状而已。那在疫情期间，我们上班，在家上班也成了一种新常态，改变了生活和工作的这种游戏规则。那根据这个美国心理学会调查显示呢，将近70%的美国人睡眠时间发生了改变，这个不是他们要主动改变的。那其中35%的人睡眠减少了，30%左右的人的睡眠增加了。那这个睡眠的这个不足或者是赤睡又会给健康造成什么样的影响？
对的，其实睡眠增加和睡眠减少这两个都是不好的信号。那什么样子是最好的呢？就是其实你的睡眠每天下来呢都比较稳定，因为人和人之间是有差别的，有些人可能他每天5个小时的睡眠他就能保证他一天精神旺盛，有些人可能需要8个小时，所以呢这个因人而异。但是呢最好是保持在你平时的这个基线上面，就是一直持续的，这样子是比较好的。那如果是这个睡眠的突然增加或者是减少，这里的话就是可能会影响到你，比如说一天第二天的工作上的精神上的一个就是精神比较差。另外呢可能记忆力也会下降，这些的话都是一个 warning， 就是 clinical warning， 需要大家引起重视的，
是一个警告的信号。
对对对对对。
那在疫情当中，有将近47%的美国人说他们推迟或者取消了看病的计划，那这对这个患有慢性疾病的人来说危害特别的大。那您对那哪些这个病患感到特别的担忧呢？
这里面其实我最担心的是一个高血压和糖尿病的这个人群，因为这两个的话其实都是需要在家庭医生那里定期复查的。像如果糖尿病在控制好的情况下呢，一般我们也建议3到6个月就要复查一次，然后呢他还需要看这个眼科医生或者是足科医生，看看有没有糖尿病相关的并发症出现。因为任何疾病都是最好的是早发现早诊断早治疗，如果是他这个耽误了，他就可能会导致最后比如说糖尿病引起的失明啊，肾功能损害之后呢，最后被迫走上了一个肾透析的情况。还有一些人呢，就是如果神经性病变了之后呢，这个肢端都会坏死，然后导致截肢。那另外如果高血压呢，他就是如果长期不治疗，他会导致这个中风的情况。因为最近一年的话，我也在临床上看到一些很年轻的病例，大概也只有30几岁，然后出现了一些中风的迹象。这也是为什么我自己在今年年初的时候呢，就自己在弄了一个诊所，就是我的诊所呢主要是focus 这个健康体检这一块。大家过来之后呢相对都放心一点，都没有其他比如说咳嗽的病人啊发热的病人都没有，在保证他这个自己不接触这些病人的情况下又能看上医生。
那我们怎么样来识别这个压力到了这个非常大的时候给我们健康发出了警讯了，我们要来怎么样识别这样的信号？
其实在家里放一个秤，这样子的话呢你就能监测到你的方方面面。比如说特别是现在还有一些秤的话还可以检测你的体脂的水平，就是如果你一直 follow 这个秤的这些 number， 然后呢 follow 你自己的这个血压的情况那你其实对自己这是一个很好的监测。如果一旦这个血压它开始升高了什么的，你就立马跟你的家庭医生去联系，因为这种的话是需要尽早的干预。而且如果是你体重增加之后出现的血压增高这种情况的话呢，你是可以通过减肥这个事情的话摘掉这个高血压的这个帽子的。因为大部分的血压 医生跟你说就是哎呀你有高血压了，你需要终身用药了，大家都不需要不喜欢听到这样的话。但是如果你是因为体重增加引起的高血压的话，你可以通过减肥来把这个高血压的帽子顶掉。
嗯，那有哪些正确的减肥方法呢金医生？
减肥呢它现在市场上也特别的火热，对于减肥其实它主要分两种，一种是美容型的减肥哈，就是其实有些人已经很瘦了，就是他 BMI 呀、也只有比如说20、21，他说哎呀我还是很胖我不满意，这个是另外一种情况，就是美容上的减肥。那现在我自己本人呢都就更注重于这个医学上的减肥，就是真正的他的这个体重是增加的，比如说 BMI 在30以上的这部分人群的话，他就会有很多的这个健康隐患，就是比如说高血压、高血脂、高血糖啊、脂肪肝，这个关节痛以后的话，还有这个睡眠的这个问题，这些的话呢，我们就可以通过一些适当的方法。那是哪些适当的方法呢？目前上，比如说有一个行为学的上的方法，我们就有这种叫 behavior module。就行为学的这些问卷调查，通过这些问卷调查呢，让病人和医生呢都更进一步的了解他目前所处的情况，比如说他是因为这个压力的问题吃的太多引起的呢，还是因为他运动减少了引起的呢，还是因为他其他的一些方面各个方面他的处理不当，或者是参加的这个 party 太多。然后在 party 上面吃的太多引起的呢，还是他这个吃的食物他的热量都特别高，但他自己没注意，就是把这些细节我们都理出来之后呢，就可以给病人一个个性化的一个指导在行为学上面。第二个方面呢，就是在食物方面的话呢，我们有一个叫低碳饮食，目前呢市场上也有很多类型的这个各种各样的 diet。我可以说这些 diet 呢基本上大部分都是有用的，但问题在于就是怎么样把它坚持下来。就是如果有一个人，不管是医生还是你自己的家里人，或者是你的这个健康方面的一个导师或者怎么样的，有个人给你监督，这样监督下面呢就会更好一些。然后但是如果你本人已经有了一些比如说高血压、高血糖、高血脂这些情况的话，那最好呢是在医生的这个监督下做一个减肥，这样子的话它既是一个减肥又是一个慢病的管理，就是可以把你这些药物给减下来。然后这些是食物上的diet 上面的，还有一个就是药物上的，最近大家可能都看到了 FDA 批准了一个新药，这个新药呢它的减肥的效果非常的好。那这个药的它的主要的作用呢就是抑制你的胃口，让你吃的少了，其实它的基本底层原理是一样的，吃的少了，那你这个摄入的这个卡路里就少了，你的机体呢就会动员起来去消耗体内的脂肪，然后实现一个减肥的效果。那另外还有一种特殊的减肥药呢，是让你吸收出现问题，就是说你脂肪类的药食物吃下去之后呢，它会导致你一个脂肪泻，这个它的效果还可以，但是好多病人都不耐受，就是经常要拉肚子。经常要拉肚子，所以说呢这些都是一些方法，具体的哪一个更适合你，比如说这种情况下呢，最好是咨询一下自己的家庭医生，或者是找专门的这个帮忙减肥的这个program， 这样的话会更加长远一些。另外还有一个我跟我的减肥的这些病人经常讲的是，我说我们减肥的话最好呢不是先减体重，是减你的这个一些 behavior， 减你的一些 mind， 就只有你真正的意识到你生活当中比如说哪一些行为是导致你体重增加的，你意识到了这个之后呢，长远来说你才可以既减肥又保持这个体重。
对，就像金医生说的，减肥主要是靠控制饮食，不过呢运动呢可以维持你的体重。那对我来说，我的运动非常的简单，就是跳绳。那跳绳对场地的要求几乎是零，它可以增强你的心肺功能，燃烧卡路里，还可以培训你的协调能力。好，非常感谢您金医生，非常感谢维吉尼亚州的家庭医生金春飞我们做的分析和解答。来宾发表的都是个人意见，并不一定代表美国之音。 感谢您收看时事大家谈，我们下次节目再会。